Previously on Beta.
Am I still in this world?
Yes, sir.
I was afraid of that.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
It's not hard to change with the times.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. All of us at Beta hope that you're safe and well during this time. None of us know exactly what's going to happen over the next few months, but we're confident that if we take things a day at a time and do our part to help each other out, we can get through this. On today's show, comedian Jenna Friedman joins us to explain why nothing is off limits when it comes to her comedy satire, Soft Focus with Jenna Friedman. And Rolling Stone's chief TV critic, Alan Sepinwall, and New York Magazine critic, Matt Zoller-Seitz, tell us how The Sopranos turned television into cinema. But first... Tommy Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. He's also the author of one of the most critically acclaimed novels of 2018. It's called They're There. Here's Tommy reading an excerpt from the prologue. And I should warn you that this reading contains some violent imagery.
Indian head. There was an Indian head. The head of an Indian. The drawing of the head of a head-dressed, long-haired Indian depicted. Drawn by an unknown artist in 1939. Broadcast until the late 1970s to American TVs everywhere, after all the shows ran out. It's called the Indian head test pattern. If you left the TV on, you'd hear a tone at 440 hertz, the tone used to tune instruments. And you'd see that Indian, surrounded by circles that looked like sights through rifle scopes. There was what looked like a bullseye in the middle of the screen with numbers like coordinates. The Indian's head was just above the bullseye, like all you'd need to do was nod up in agreement to set the sights on the target. This was just a test. In 1621, colonists invited Massasoit, the chief of the Wampanoags, to a feast after a recent land deal. Massasoit came with 90 of his men. That meal is why we still eat a meal together in November, celebrated as a nation. But that one wasn't a Thanksgiving meal, it was a land deal meal. 2 years later, there was another similar meal meant to symbolize eternal friendship. 200 Indians dropped dead that night from an unknown poison. By the time Massasoit's son, Metacomet, became chief, there were no Indian pilgrim meals being eaten together. Metacomet, also known as King Philip, was forced to sign a peace treaty to give up all Indian guns. 3 of his men were hanged. His brother Wamsutta was, let's say, very likely poisoned after being summoned and seized by the Plymouth court, all of which led to the first official Indian war, the first war with Indians, King Philip's War. 3 years later, the war was over and Metacomet was on the run. He was caught by Benjamin Church, the captain of the very first American Rangers, and an Indian by the name of John Alderman. Metacomet was beheaded and dismembered, quartered. They tied his 4 body sections to nearby trees for the birds to pluck. Alderman was given Metacomet's hand, which he kept in a jar of rum and for years took around with him, charged people to see it. Metacomet's head was sold to Plymouth Colony for 30 shillings, the going rate for an Indian head at the time. The head was put on a spike, carried through the streets of Plymouth, then displayed at Plymouth Fort for the next 25 years.
Tommy, when did you get the idea for your debut novel, There, There?
So it was a single moment. I had just found out I was going to be a father. It was in 2010, at the end of 2010. I was driving down to L.A. to go see a show, this pianist, Chilly Gonzalez. And on the drive, the idea just popped right into my head. I'd been working in the urban Indian community in Oakland for many years, and I knew I wanted to write a novel. At that moment, the idea to have... A story about urban Indians where all their lives converge at a shooting at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. That single sort of container for the novel is what I thought of in that single moment.
And one of the decisions you made, I don't know if this came right out of the gate, but you decided that you were going to have 12 characters. Why did you decide to have that many characters?
I just like those kinds of novels. I like shifting perspectives. I think it's true to life. I think we get a lot of voices and we have to try to make sense of it, and it all does interconnect somehow. There's also kind of like a monolithic version of what Native people are supposed to look like and be like, stoic or sad or drunk or dumb or historic. Yeah. There's all these negative. So to explore a dynamic range of voices for people that normally have either no voice or it's a false voice or it's a stereotype, it seemed interesting and like a way to expand the range of the way we're thought of.
By having so many characters, it also makes the reader more invested in their thoughts and lives because so many of them are related to one another, and we have to read closely to keep track of who is who, and it allows us to see a wide variety of Native Americans as individuals, which is a key part, maybe the most important part of what makes your novel work so well. What do you think?
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to do and what novels try to do and at their best succeed greatly is make people have empathy for people in lives that they may not otherwise think of or not have the same empathy for. Put people in a whole bunch of different shoes, give them a world and what it feels like, and they'll understand more. And I think, expand on what humanity is and all that it entails.
Mm-hmm. And all 12 of the characters, correct me if I'm wrong, but all 12 of them are members of the working class, right? That was probably a conscious decision on your part?
Definitely. I mean, I think when you look at a lot of literature, it is upper middle class. It's often New York-based. There's often college-educated characters. A lot of times not very much happens. Ennui is the biggest problem.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And so, stuff happened in my life, and the people that I've known have been working class, and so I wanted to represent that in literature, and it almost seemed like, I mean, it hasn't not been done, but it's not done enough, and literature belongs everywhere, not just in the upper middle class.
Yeah, definitely. You spent, I think, 6 years working on There. What was that experience like? Was it a struggle to get this all down on paper the way you wanted it to be?
It was a messy, messy endeavor, and I'm very happy that I got out of it and a book came out. In the middle, it was a struggle to see how they were all going to connect.
Yeah.
You know, when I first read it, and somebody doing it in a novel, I wondered, like, how did they do that? And so I set myself to the task of figuring out how somebody does it. And I don't know that I have an answer. It's just continually focusing on the same vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran a lot, and a lot of the deeper solutions would come to me when I ran.
Yeah, I love the prologue. It was extremely powerful, and it told me a lot of very heartbreaking history that I'm embarrassed to admit that I wasn't familiar with. Why did you want to open your book this way?
Well, first, I just like prologues and what they do. I like that they contextualize the story before you get there. I think you can be experimental with a prologue, and I like that. I also like that you can skip it. Some people don't like prologues, and you can skip it, and it's not necessary. I mean, I think it is necessary for my book, but you can skip it.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, a lot of times people go back. Mm-hmm. If they're interested enough in the book, then they'll read it later. But also, you know, probably the biggest reason was to understand what an urban Indian is. You kind of have to go back to relocation, which is embedded in termination policy, which was like kill the Indian, save the man. And genocidal policy leads to genocide, real genocide, which happened in various different kinds of cases. And I grew up hearing the Sand Creek Massacre story. I knew I wanted that to be a part of the prologue. So just before you can get to the urban Indian story in contemporary times, I really wanted to get everyone who's reading the book on the same page about how we got there.
You grew up in Oakland, which is the setting of There. What was your childhood like?
On my street, there was about five other families that were, so there's like a half black and half Jewish kid, a good friend of mine still, half black, half Italian kid, half white, half Hawaiian kid, another Native kid who's half Mexican, half Native. We grew up on the street. It was a one-way street, and we had a park down the hill that you didn't really want to go to at night, but that we played in during the day, and we kind of, it was in some ways an idyllic childhood where I had a set of friends and went to school, and maybe one other kid was Native. In a sense, we knew there weren't very many Native kids around. But we grew up with my dad, who his first language was Cheyenne, and he grew up with his great-grandparents in a way that Native people don't live like anymore. So we grew up around him. So it was a very urban Oakland experience, but the heaviest Native influence or what made us feel that way was our dad. And speaking in Cheyenne, he didn't teach us. It was kind of more of a time of assimilation. But we were very aware of it. And there were certain stories that he told and made sure we knew about. And I didn't actually know there was an urban Indian community until I started working in it in my 20s.
One of my favorite characters in there is Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield. Can you tell me a bit about her?
Yeah, she was one of the earlier characters to appear. First year of writing the book, I was just sort of auditioning voices. I was trying out different voices almost on a daily basis for that first year. Whatever felt like it had staying power, it stuck, or it felt distinct and it felt like a sort of effortlessness to it, I would follow that voice. And Opal appeared early on.
Is there any one character among the 12 characters in there that is based on you?
I would say they're all more me than anyone else. I worked in various different storytelling capacities over the years through an organization out of Berkeley, and also at the center that I worked at, we had a storytelling project. So I worked with a lot of people's stories and came to feel that I would never want to tell somebody else's story or sort of steal somebody's story.
Where does the title there come from?
Gertrude Stein says about Oakland in everybody's autobiography. Somebody's asking, why doesn't she write about Oakland? And she says, well, there is no there. When I came across that doing research for the novel, it just struck me as true of the Native experience and what was there before. There's no more there, what it looked like to be Native before. So finding a way to belong to something that is no longer visible and feels like it may not have a there, specifically for people living in Oakland and trying to find a way to belong to your environment and where you were born and raised. So there being the reference that Gertrude Stein was talking about, and there being the experience of all these characters, the there is what I'm trying to get at. Also, people have used that quote out of context to talk about how Oakland has no sense of place or no soul or no character, which is a very convenient position to have for a city getting gentrified. Like, there's nothing there anyway. We can just, you know, that's the sort of position that settlers had. Like, it's just a wilderness that we can march across and there's no one here. There's a sense that, you know, the way Indians were here doesn't count because we're savages. And that's the way, you know, even in the Declaration of Independence, we're referred to as merciless savages. That's still in there.
Following up on there, it's also the title. It's also the name of a Radiohead song, which you reference in the book, don't you?
Yeah, that was a serendipitous moment. So I decided on there as a title. Hail to the Thief is the album that's on. But I actually pirated that album. And the pirated version that I got only had track 01, track 02, all the way down to, I think, 14 songs on that album. And so I knew the song is number 9 on Hail to the Thief. I stumbled on the fact that it was called there because I Googled there to see if it was a title for somebody else's book. So the lyrics to there, the song, they match the theme of the book. So, like, one of the lyrics is, just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there. So you have these characters sort of questioning their authenticity, and they feel like they are Indian, but what does that mean? Yeah. And we are accidents waiting to happen is another line from that song, and that's sort of, you know, the trajectory of the book is very much that.
You created the word Indianing, which you use very effectively in your novel. Can you tell me how you came up with that word and what it means to you?
Yeah, I think particularly with Native people, if somebody finds out you're Native, well, one of the first things that they say, or in my experience, and this happened on the tour recently, they ask me if I'm Native, and I say yes, and then the follow-up is always, well, how much? And so people want to know what makes you Indian, whether it's blood or what do you do, the verb of Indianing. In college, I wrote a paper on called Chekhov's Indian, so if the gun appears in the first act, it's going to go off by the third.
Yeah.
Basically talking about how to write Indian without doing the typically Indian stuff. If you introduce an Indian, do they have to do something Indian? And this is all based on stereotype and authenticity. And the stick we have to measure ourselves by is this old version of what being Indian is. And we need to expand the conversation about how many different things it can mean.
What does it mean for you to be Native American here in 2018?
My particular experience, it sort of is heavily now embedded in being a Native author and speaking about, you know, what that means.
Yeah.
So it's become abstracted in a way. before the book, it's just who I am. Like, I don't know, there's no separate way for me to think of, like, well, what if I wasn't? You know, it's something that I've known from a very young age, and my dad did a good job of making sure that we knew where we come from, and my sister just became fluent, and I'm very interested in learning more about that, because a lot of Cheyenne values and belief systems is embedded in the language itself, and it's a little harder to teach.
That's Tommy Orange talking about his novel, They're There. You can find out more about Tommy on our website, WPR.org/beta. Rolling Stone's chief TV critic Alan Sepinwall and fellow critic Matt Soller-Seitz tell us how The Sopranos broke the rules and reinvented television in the process. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta.
Now, wait a minute. I'd like to propose a toast to my family. Someday soon, you're gonna have families of your own. And if you're lucky, you'll remember the little moments. Like this. That were good. Cheers.
That's James Gandolfini as New Jersey mob boss Tony Soprano. The Sopranos premiered on HBO on January 10th, 1999, and TV has not been the same since. The show's creator, David Chase, wasn't a fan of television, so he decided to transform TV into cinema. Matt Soller-Seitz and Alan Sepinwall were handling the TV beat for the Newark Star-Ledger when the series began. They had a front-row seat to the show and launched a new era in TV criticism with their artful analysis. They've compiled their work into the book, The Sopranos Sessions. Here's Seitz.
It was an unbelievable stroke of good fortune that I happened to end up at that particular paper at that particular time with the background that I had being a film critic who was fairly new to television criticism. And the first time I ever met David was fall of 1998, and they were shooting a scene on Roosevelt Island off of Manhattan. And the interview was me and him sitting and folding metal chairs out on the edge of the water, and it was cold and plumes of breath were coming out of our mouths. And he was talking about Fellini and Antonioni and Godard and all of these European art house cinema filmmakers who shaped him. And I thought, I've never had a conversation like this with anyone who produced a television show before. And how amazing that the circumstances are like something that you would see in one of the films he's describing.
And The Sopranos really launched your careers for you, in which both of you elevated the art of the recap. You transformed the recap into the episode review, and there are a lot of other critics doing this now. How do you both feel about being the pioneers of this format?
It's a strange thing. I remember I started doing it in college, even before The Sopranos, for the cop show NYPD Blue. Mm. And I, in turn, was inspired by a math teacher named Tim Lynch, who was recapping Star Trek episodes. And I remember I read those and I thought, wait, you can just write about an episode of television? But it really wasn't until we were each writing about The Sopranos for the paper that I feel like I came into my own in doing this. Like, I would come in on a Monday, someone got whacked in the episode the night before, and I would say to my editors, people are going to want to talk about this. Save me some space on the Tuesday front page, and I'm going to write about it. And those always got a much bigger response than anything else I wrote for the paper, including advanced reviews of Soprano seasons. And I realized there is an appetite for this. For a show this complex, people want to talk about it long past the time they spent watching it.
Mm. I was able to convince my editors at the Star-Ledger to let me write about individual episodes, like basically episode reviews. But there had to be some special justification for it. And often it was that, you know, some major event, some kind of obviously event that was obviously flagged as being major had happened, like, you know, somebody gave birth or some important character died. Like, I wrote an episode review of NYPD Blue when Jimmy Smits died. Mm. And I did an episode, pieces on like season finales and things like that. And, you know, episodes of ER where they would kill people off in a grisly fashion, I might write something about that, or the West Wing episode Two Cathedrals, which was, you know, great. I think Alan and I both would rank that among our favorite episodes of the time that we've been writing about TV. But I would often make the case of just like, especially when we got a website, why don't you let me recap everything? Why don't you just, since I'm watching the show anyway and I'm looking for every excuse I can to write about it, why don't I just write about every episode? And the answer was, the readers don't want that. Well, it turns out that they did.
I think seeing him again will be very therapeutic for me.
It's not supposed to be therapeutic for you. This is your therapy here.
Do you have sexual feelings for him?
No. I have feelings. On a personal level.
Why do you think that such a large audience let these sociopathic, unlikable characters into their homes for 8 years?
First, it was great.
They were funny. That helped. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. They were funny. Gandolfini gave the greatest performance in TV drama history. You know, he was so charismatic. Edie Falco, Nancy Marchand, Lorraine Bracco, Dominic Chinese. So many of the performances in the show were fantastic. It was well-written. It was well-directed. Like, and obviously, quality will not always guarantee an audience. But it was sort of this perfect storm where before The Sopranos, the approach to getting a big audience in TV is the lowest common denominator approach. You dumb things down. You sand off the edges. You make everything as palatable and simply easy to digest as possible for people. This went the other way. This went really complex in terms of morality, in terms of characterization, storytelling, everything. But it covered so many different, like, you know, parts of the Venn diagram. Mm. So you had you brought in the people who just wanted a gangster story. You brought in the people who could relate to the family drama of the Soprano family.
And it's very deliberate that Chase saying, like, he wanted this to appeal to women.
Yes.
He didn't want it to be just a bunch of sweaty guys whacking each other. Like, it was very important to him that his wife and his family and everybody in the domestic sphere be equally important.
Yeah, and there was a lot of fans who just wanted the mob show and would get impatient with that, or with the psychiatry and the dream episodes and all of those things. But the show was all of it, so it had these different constituencies who together, stitched together, became this huge audience and became this phenomenon that changed television as we know it.
It did something that movies had been doing since the 60s. Really since the late 60s and on through the 70s and beyond, which was giving you a main character who was complicated and charismatic and maybe even funny and entertaining, but was not supposed to be somebody who exemplified the correct way to live. You know, he wasn't a role model. And it was okay. It became, after a certain point, okay to have an anti-hero as your main character in a movie. It had been okay to have an anti-hero as a main character in on the stage and in novels for, you know, hundreds of years. But television, for some reason, remained immune for that. And with very few exceptions, many of them unsuccessful. And even on shows that were largely driven by the antics of a villain or an anti-hero, like, say, Dallas or Oz, which preceded The Sopranos on HBO by 2 years, you still had characters who were, in theory, the main characters who were the good people. Mm. You know, like, yeah, they represented the institution.
Yeah.
And you didn't have that here, and you had to decide, like, how did that make you feel? Like, to sound like Melfi, but, like, now that you're empathizing with this murderous, you know, thief and serial philanderer and glutton and all these other, you know, qualities that we think are unflattering. How does that make you feel? Do you feel good when you look in the mirror that you're so interested in this person?
There you go. Yeah. You both have compiled top 10 lists of your favorite Sopranos episodes. Alan, you seem to favor the more plot-driven, climactic episodes. And Matt, you seem to gravitate toward the more meditative episodes. But you both have some episodes in common, including season one's College. Let's talk a bit about this episode. Alan, can you give us a brief synopsis of College and why it's your number one pick?
All right, so in College, there's two plots. One of them is Tony and Meadow are touring colleges in New England, and while they're in the midst of going from one place to another, Tony recognizes a guy named Febby Petrullio, a former family associate who turned rat, and he has gone into the witness protection program, and Tony decides he's going to get his revenge on Febby, and he hunts him down. And the other plot is Carmela is home with Father Phil, and there's a big rainstorm, and they spend a long sort of dark night of the soul together, and you wonder if they're going to sleep together, and Carmela is grappling with her feelings about her philandering husband and about being a mob wife.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 4 weeks since my last confession. What am I talking about? That's a lie. I haven't truly confessed in 20 years.
Go on.
I have forsaken what is right for what is easy. Allowing what I know is evil in my house. Allowing my children, oh my God, my sweet children, to be a part of it. Because I wanted things for them. I wanted a better life, good schools. I wanted this house. Wanted money in my hands, money to buy anything I ever wanted. I'm so ashamed.
This was the episode where The Sopranos really became The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, the first four episodes are good, but if you read the reviews written off of those four episodes, they're kind of mixed to positive. They're intrigued by it, but really not sure, and the show is still figuring it out tonally. And then college, that was when everyone that Monday morning started raving and telling their friends, have you seen the show called The Sopranos? You have to see it. Because David Chase insisted that Tony kill Phoebe with his bare hands at the end of it, which had never really been done before in this kind of context on a show. And he took the character further than even HBO expected that he would. And he said, if he doesn't do this here, the audience will stop believing in him as this character I've created. And he was right.
You know how much trouble you're in now? You took an oath and you broke it.
I could have killed you last night outside the motel. Your daughter was drunk, remember? I was there in the parking lot. I had a gun, but I didn't do it. Because of her, I told myself, it's just a coincidence. He's taking his little girl to college.
You know, one thing about us wise guys, the hustle never ends. You shot me at that motel, your life would have been flushed down a piece of dude.
Please, Tony, I'm begging.
Yeah, and in the book you say this is the purest distillation of the show's mafia family and domestic family themes in the ways that Tony's work in the mafia family utterly taints the family, his personal
Well, and also
family.
the idea of dual identities, which mm-hmm. is important for at least three of those four major characters, Tony, Carmela, and Father Phil. And you know, the episode ends with Tony sitting out in a lobby waiting for his daughter to have an interview at one of the colleges that they're touring, and he looks up and he sees an inscription from Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, which, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, basically, a person who wears one face for himself and another to the world will eventually become confused as to which is true.
Mm.
And that reflects on him, but also, of course, The Scarlet Letter is a story about a woman who falls in love with a priest.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's resonating on kind of a literary level as well.
Yeah. Another episode that showed up on both of your top 10 lists is probably the most popular Sopranos episode. It's called Pine Barrens, and it's from season 3. Can you guys set up this episode and tell us why it's so memorable?
Yeah, Pine Barrens is
there's an interior decorator.
Oh, yeah, he killed 15 Czechoslovakians, yeah.
His apartment looked terrible. No, yeah. Paulie and Christopher are sent to collect a debt.
16, sorry. 16
they're sent to collect a debt from, like, a Russian associate of the mob, and it goes bad quickly, and instead they wind up, they think that they've killed him. They decide to drive down to the Pine Barrens, which is a famous sort of enormous forest/nature preserve in southern New Jersey, to bury him. And they get there and they discover that he's still alive. And he manages to escape from them. And they get lost in the woods and don't know what to do.
Could be him out there stalking us.
Think about it, Chrissy. Even if he's alive, he's unarmed and bleeding like a sieve. He's in the woods. He's in his pajamas.
Probably thinks we left anyway.
If he's alive, which he ain't. What's that?
Nathan's bag.
There's some ketchups in. They clean?
I don't know. They were in the bag. They were a little halfway frozen.
Give me some. Not bad. Mix it with the relish.
And this is the beauty of it, and I don't think I fully grasped this until the rewatch, but, you know, everybody thinks of that as the episode where Paulie and Christopher are tangling with the Russian in the woods. And that is, in fact, the first thing you remember, because it's really funny and scary and just really well done by Steve Buscemi, who directed four episodes, all of which I think are excellent in their own way. But there's this larger story which encompasses it, which is the story of the effect of Tony's irresponsibility and absentee landlord kind of approach to his job, what that does to everybody else, like whether it's his wife, his mistress, his children, or the underlings who work for him, they're all suffering from inattention of this guy who's supposed to be paying attention and supposed to be listening, and he's just too selfish and distracted to do his job in any sense.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we can't talk about The Sopranos without talking about the series finale, an episode called Made in America. How does this very last episode of The Sopranos end?
Oh, I like how you phrased that. Well, it ends with the family. It ends with the family in Holston's Diner in Bloomfield, New Jersey, eating onion rings, and it looks like a perfectly ordinary dinner out. But it's shot and cut in an extremely menacing, suspenseful way. Like, and you feel that something horrible could happen at any moment. Even though, as Alan and I talked about in our dialogue about this episode in the book, There's nothing, there's actually no data in the scene to indicate that anybody in the family is more anxious than they would normally be if they were eating out. And even the behavior of most of the characters on the show, if you just look at the actions, which is guy at the counter looks at a family, gets up and goes to the restroom, that happens a million times in diners across the United States. Why do we think that that's important? Well, it's because of the way it's shot. And it's one of the two episodes that David Chase directed. But I will say that, you know, the question of what happened in the end, I think that's as Chase himself put it a few years ago when he felt that another journalist had misquoted him about what happened. It's a spiritual question that has no correct answer.
It was work today.
All I'm doing is getting coffee and placing his phone calls.
You may not realize it, but you are making contacts.
It's an entry-level job. So buck up.
All right. Focus on the good times.
Don't be sarcastic.
Isn't that what you said one time? Try and remember the times that were good?
I did?
Yeah.
Well, it's true, I guess.
And that's not to say that he doesn't have certain inclinations, which Alan and I teased out of him. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah. We were interviewing him, and we did 7 long interviews over the course, 1 for each season. And we knew we would have to deal with the end in the last of those. Uh-huh. And we've talked to him a lot. He hates discussing the finale. He usually clams up. Yeah. So we hadn't come up with a strategy yet. And then we were doing the 6th interview. And we weren't talking about the finale at all. We were talking just in general about planning for the ending, but not actually doing the ending. And suddenly, without warning, Chase says the phrase, "Well, I had that death scene planned about 2 years before we actually did it."
Yes.
And he kept talking, and he gives this answer. And at the end of it, Matt Zoller Seitz says, "David, you realize you just referred to that as a death scene."
Mm-hmm.
And Chase realized what he had said, and he glares at both of us. And then, you know, almost with a laugh, he says something that I cannot say on the radio. And we all laughed. And then, to our amazement, it was like once he had said that, the dam burst, and he was willing to talk to us for about 45 minutes. And it turned out death scene was actually referring to a completely different ending that he didn't do, that he abandoned. But it does sort of speak to the idea that the scene at the ice cream parlor is about death, whether or not Tony dies, you know, which at this point I'm not really interested in that answer. I'm just interested in the way it makes me feel and what it makes me think about.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite parts of this job is the chance to interview creative people and ask them about the craft aspect of what they do. And, like, what were you trying to do here? Were you able to execute it to your satisfaction? Was there any part of it that maybe that you changed in the process? And if so, why? Like, all of these kinds of, you know, like if somebody was building a redwood deck on the back of their house, you would ask them these sorts of questions. And these are the kinds of ones that I live for. And the answers are always really illuminating for me. And what I discovered with Alan interviewing David Chase is he was extremely intentional about certain things and very much going by instinct or intuition with other things, and sometimes a little bit of both. And also, just, you know, going back to the idea of psychoanalysis being important on this show, I think it's really important in the creative process and as critics to sort of understand how the human mind works. And you and I, throughout our lives, do things on purpose that we didn't mean to do. Like, we look back over it and we go, like, wow, that feels like an accident. That feels like a coincidence. But in retrospect, maybe I meant to do that. And I think the ending is a perfect case of that. Like, I completely believe David, and I understand his frustration when he says that he originally had this kind of oblique scene in mind that was supposed to be interpreted as he died.
That was the Lincoln Tunnel idea?
Tony was the last scene of the show was going to be Tony driving through the Lincoln Tunnel for a meeting with Johnny Sack, the New York mob boss. And the scene was either going to cut to black or fade to white. I can't remember which. But it was definitely going to feel like a note of finality somehow. And I think you would come away from that going, well, he probably didn't come back from that meeting. Like, we don't see the meeting, but the implication is that whatever it was, it didn't go well for Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved away from that. He very deliberately moved away from that. And one of the reasons he moved away from that was he thought it was too easy and too cliched to kill the gangster hero at the end of the gangster story, and he didn't want to do that. So he moved away, and he eventually settled on this Holson's thing. However, you know, and I asked him a bunch of extremely explicit follow-up questions because I didn't want him to be misconstrued. And one of them was, is it possible that even though you deliberately moved away from this idea of Tony getting killed, a lifetime of consuming gangster movies where the guy gets killed at the end might have still given this whole scene a feeling of they killed him? And he said, yeah, that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have killed Tony without meaning to kill Tony. You know, like it's like another Freudian slip, except on a grand scale.
Yeah. What is the Sopranos legacy?
The Sopranos legacy is what television is right now. That show you binged on Netflix over the weekend, that does not exist without The Sopranos. You know, that comedy you watched with a relatively unlikable lead character, that doesn't exist without The Sopranos. Extreme serialization in television, all of the things that we think scripted TV has become in these last 20 years can be traced to the success of this show, because there were all these unwritten rules about how television was supposed to function and what the audience would and would not accept. And the success of the show revealed all of those rules to be incorrect.
Well, and to build on something that Alan said earlier, you know, this was a show, because it was a hit, for whatever reason, you know, everybody had a different reason why they watched the show. But because it was a big hit, it gave other people who made television permission to make the kind of show that gave the audience what it wanted, not what they thought the audience wanted. That was really important. And I love that. And that's one of the reasons why the show is dear to my heart, and why many of the recent shows that I love so much are also in that vein, like shows like Atlanta and The Americans, because I like a show that tells me who's boss, you know, that doesn't give me what it thinks I want. It gives me what it wants. And it's up to me to decide if I like it or not. Like, I respect a show that has the guts to be that.
Yeah. What would you guys tell someone who's never watched The Sopranos to convince them that they should watch it?
Because its DNA can be found in every show they have liked, in the recent years.
Yeah.
I would say that, and this is true for me, is like I look at television and I look at myself differently as a result of having watched The Sopranos.
That's New York Magazine's Matt Zoller-Seitz and Rolling Stone's chief TV critic, Alan Sepinwall. They are the authors of The Sopranos Sessions. You can find out more about Matt and Alan on our website, wpr.org/beta.
Ultimately, I just wanted to like sugarcoat ideas about consent and have people talking about consent.
Comedian Jenna Friedman offers us a light touch on hard issues. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. I should warn you that our next conversation contains mature material and discussions of rape. If you like dark comedy, you'll probably like Jenna Friedman. Her fellow comedian Brock Wilbur describes Jenna as the comedian who occupies a spectrum of comedy so dark it is almost impossible to see her. So does Jenna agree?
You know, I would prior to 2016. I think now our country's darkness has like caught up with me. I think I'm just kind of talking about what's happening, and I used to get a lot of comparisons to like Edward Gorey if he were animated a little bit more.
Are you an Edward Gorey fan?
I love Edward Gorey, yeah.
You've said that comedy is both art and entertainment. Can you explain what you mean by that?
The entertainment aspect is just that we need other people to do what we do. I have always been envious of visual artists or musicians because I think they can create in a closed environment, but comedians need an audience to know if our jokes are funny. We need an audience to make our art. It's varying degrees of art, you know, depending on the type of comedy you want to do. If you want to make people laugh all the time, I think it's more entertainment. If you want to make people laugh but also maybe challenge them, it's a little closer to art. There's also spoken word, which I fall into if nobody laughs, and you're just an artist.
The art side of the equation in comedy is very important to you, I think, because you really do want to make people think about things.
Yeah, I mean, it's not funny to talk about your motivations like that, especially in this moment. We still have free speech to some degree. Why not use it? You gotta flaunt it while you have it. I don't know.
You've said that your favorite comedians are able to make sense of things that the rest of us have trouble understanding. Can you point to an example from your own comedy that helps make sense of things? Maybe something from your set on Conan O'Brien's show last year?
I feel silly kind of talking about my own stuff in that way, but when you did mention the Conan set, I think it was this moment after Charlottesville. I was so sad. And you're watching these guys with AR-15s exercising their free speech. And there was a lot of debate about, what do we do? Do we let Nazis speak publicly while they're exercising their free speech? And a lot of comedians and different takes actually had, you know, people were like, don't punch Nazis. And so I was trying to understand it and find comedy in it. And being Jewish, I do feel like I have license to kind of go a little further regarding Nazis. Here's my advice. If you see a Nazi on the street, don't punch him, but maybe lightly harass him. Catcall him. Tell him to smile. If any Nazis work for you, pay them less. Take credit for their ideas. Except that one.
That was a really great set, and you talked about Nazis. You also, you had some great jokes about men at the beginning. It was very funny and very smart.
What a weird time we're living in. I just hope all this Trump stuff doesn't make it even harder in the future for men to become president. Poor men. Oh. Poor men. You guys have had a rough couple weeks. I love men. One of my best friends is a man. I'm actually half man on my dad's side. So thank you. I get it. You know, it's a rough time. But lately, I've developed a very rational fear of men based on how you portray yourselves in person. Like if I'm walking down the street and I see a group of businessmen, I don't know what the term is, like a fraud. If I see a scam of men in suits coming towards me, I'll find that I'll just instinctively clutch my purse and be like, don't grope me, you know? Don't grope me, I'm awake. You know? Sometimes hard issues need a light touch. I'm Jenna Friedman, and this is Soft Focus.
Let's talk about your Adult Swim series, Soft Focus. The show finds you talking to real people out in the field. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I worked at The Daily Show. I was a field producer there. And even prior to that, I was doing field pieces, and I have some interviews online that are quite dated where I talk to different characters in the world. I just like that stuff. I like combining comedy with real people. It's funnier to me when it's unscripted. It just feels relevant in a way because you're actually talking to people.
Can you tell me a bit about the story about campus rape in the debut episode of Soft Focus? It's not like any other story about the subject that I've ever seen.
So that episode is on YouTube. If you Google Soft Focus campus rape, you'll find it. Adult Swim is like a real comedy network. They do a lot of experimental stuff. A lot of their audience are kind of younger guys. And I just wanted to find an actually funny way to talk to them about that subject.
Mm-hmm.
So the segment, it's kind of making fun of the investigative journalist, the intrepid reporter who is trying to uncover things but maybe isn't as above board as she should be. But ultimately, like, I just wanted to, like, sugarcoat ideas about consent and have people talking about consent. And it is such, like, a lightning rod of a topic.
To flesh it out a bit, you had these fraternity members, these three guys, and you incorporated the sex dolls by saying they were no consent dolls.
Meet your new friend, cannot consent Carrie. Cannot consent Carrie, cannot consent, because she cannot speak. You are to take her around with you. Show her a good time like you would any new friend or incoming freshman girl. But most importantly, treat her with respect and make sure your friends do the same. Any questions?
So we really have to carry them around for like the next couple days?
Good question, yes. They're quite heavy.
but not as heavy as the emotional burden that rape victims must carry around with them at all times.
Your fellow comedian Jen Kirkman has an important comment about rape in her Netflix stand-up special, Just Keep Living, which you've mentioned in interviews. Jen said,
rape exists, and I'm going to talk about that. That's not a rape joke. That's a rape fact. And I'll stop talking about rape when men stop raping everybody, so don't give me a little outrage. Ooh,
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I have a joke that is inspired by experience that has to do with date rape. Not my own experience, but I did actually have a job interview a while ago with a guy who had, like, date raped a friend of mine. And then I wrote a joke about it, and I've been trying to get that on late night, but the general consensus is we can't air that. I think that men are afraid to air things because a rape joke from a female perspective is a completely different joke than from a male perspective. And even if you're a woman on late night as a guest on someone's show, it's still filtered through the lens of the host.
Yes.
It would be cool if there were female hosts in late night as well, so that I think some of the jokes that might be uncomfortable coming from a male host show would be seen in a different context coming from a female host show.
Definitely. Late Night with Jenna Friedman has a nice ring to it, don't you think?
Sure, why not?
In 2013, New York was gripped by the case of the cannibal cop, an NYPD police officer who plotted to eat his wife and her friends online, with harmless quotes like, "I want her to experience being cooked alive," and, "I'm not into the humane stuff either. It's personal with Andrea. She will absolutely suffer." He has since served time in prison, and he's even written a book about his experience. Here to talk about it, the cannibal cop himself, Gil Valle.
I remember following his story and thinking it was fascinating because it was really just about, can you be prosecuted for thought crimes? And the reality is he did at one point do something that fell under the, I guess, definition of conspiracy to commit murder.
Mm-hmm. But he never acted on it, right? And he was actually acquitted, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. After 7 months in solitary confinement, which we glossed over because that's never very funny, I saw an article about him in the New York Post, Bastion of Journalism, about how he was dating again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wanted to talk to him. Because if you're dating again and you are the cannibal cop, I want people to know that. It was almost like a public service announcement. And he was a really good sport, and all of that was unscripted, and not enough people saw it, and it's one of the funniest things I think I've ever done. How do you distinguish mm-hmm. between somebody plotting to cook people for fun and someone plotting to cook people for business?
What distinguishes a fantasy plot from a real plot are real life actions.
And there was only one instance where you plotted to meet someone and you did.
Well, right, the female in Maryland.
Yeah. Do you guys still keep in touch?
No, I haven't spoken to her.
You're never going to eat women.
Never going to eat women. It was all a fictional fantasy. I would never dream of doing anything without anybody's consent.
Well, you could dream it, but that's not a crime. We made sure, because it was unscripted, we kind of ambushed him with a dating game.
Today is your lucky day because you are on Meet Your Match.
Was that an idea that came a little later on in your creative process when you were planning this?
No, that was immediately the first idea. I didn't even know if we were going to do an interview.
Oh,
but
interesting.
The thing that did kind of come about later was the idea that we wanted one of the women in the dating game to actually be somebody who would date him. So at the last minute, we're like, put an ad out on like a fetish website where like find a woman who likes drinking blood or something. And it played out beautifully because she actually, like, again, no one knew who he was. They really thought that they were contestants on a dating game, which they were.
And finally, we have Ashua. She's a singer and actor with a BS in criminal justice.
I can relate to that.
It's not your turn to talk. Okay. Alice, what's your question for Gil?
Gil, would you describe yourself as conservative in the bedroom or willing to try new things?
Definitely willing to try new things.
Claiborne, ask away.
Gil, what's more important in a relationship, trust or lust?
trust every time, absolutely. It's important to be open and honest, and that was my mistake in my marriage.
Shh, don't talk about your exes.
Okay.
You've been working in comedy for, what, I think 15 years now. How do you think the comedy industry has changed for women over that time?
It's definitely gotten a lot better. Just from like 2004 to 2016, it really was like this one tiny space in our culture that I could see actual change happen. Comedy became more inclusive, more feminist. It was exciting, and it's still exciting.
That's comedian Jenna Friedman. Soft Focus can be seen on Adult Swim or on YouTube. You can also find out more about Jenna at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Tommy Orange, Alan Sepinwall, Matt Zoller-Seitz, and Jenna Friedman. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Glotcher.
Hey, buddy, turn it down!
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You can get around with me, okay? But not when the other guys are there. Gotta maintain respect.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon. Take care and stay safe.
What are you a bad guy once you get to know him?